Joe, want to hear something about me? Okay.
He doesn't remember.
Association.
For me, you'll find that my approach to hypnosis is very much rooted in my experience with Eastern philosophy, religion, psychology, meditation. Turn that off. Okay. I've been involved in Buddhist communities all my adult life. I was in the first Zen Buddhist monastery in this country called Tassajara. Anybody have a Tassajara book?
I've heard of
it. Yeah, yeah. That's where it came from. It was written while I was there. And in fact, I worked in the kitchen when the guy
was there. Where's that located?
Carmel Valley. In the mountains. Those Padres, maybe? Used to, there's famous hot springs in the 1800s, and people still, in the summer, the monastery runs it as a guest, they have a guest season where people come and have these fabulous gourmet vegetarian meals, and they get to use the hot tubs.
This is near Esalen, is it?
Yeah, not as far south.
Yeah,
no.
Okay. Yeah, I met another woman, a Buddhist monk from there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can't recall her name.
Well, I was there for 4 years with a man named Suzuki Roshi. He started it. He has a little book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I would recommend to all of you. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Suzuki is his name, as in the motorcycle. He died in 1971. And I started studying with a Tibetan Lama named Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And I studied with him until he died in 1987, so that's 16 years. He has several books. There's many, many books. Some of his earlier, more notable books are Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, The Myth of Freedom. Born in Tibet is his autobiography up until about the age of 25, including his escape from Tibet during the Chinese invasion. More recent book, Shambhala, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. If you just get one of those written down, you'll be able to find the list of all the others in it. So.
Cutting through the what?
Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. My interest in neurolinguistic programming and hypnosis is only a function of my recognition that they are touching into these primordial recognitions, these ancient recognitions of the truth that I was exposed to with my teachers in the Buddhist tradition. Currently I'm studying with this woman. Her name is Guru Mai Chidvalasananda. She's not a Buddhist, she's a Siddhi Yoga master. Different tradition, but same heart, same truth. It's sort of like Chinese dolls for me, where hypnosis is the smallest one, and then hypnotherapy is a little bigger, and then NLP is bigger than that, but the biggest one is these teachings, which for me come from the East, but they're also, it's harder to find them, but they're actually, there are esoteric traditions in the West. They're just not, you know, they've been suppressed for centuries, so they're not easily recognizable.
Is she a living master?
She's a living master. In fact, she's currently in this country in upstate New York. It's called South Falls, New York. She has her main ashram in the West here, and she has her ashram in India, and there's centers all over the world. So that's where I'm coming from so far. Buddhism is, you know, Buddhism is like any of these traditions. It's not just one thing, and it doesn't just come in one flavor or one color. There are some sects of Buddhism. Well, first of all, any of these traditions are colored, very much colored by the culture that they arise out of as they're moving, and the same thing is going to happen here. In some places, it's more of a religion than others, in terms of the people relating to it as something external. The truths, actually, the viewpoint of Buddhism actually is not really religious, it's more of an existential viewpoint. It doesn't require belief in anything. And it doesn't really care to involve itself in discussions of God or whatever. The viewpoint of Buddhism is to figure out what we can know and go from there without relying on belief, you know, is to test everything. Even the Buddha said, you know, don't take anything I say for granted, you know, test it yourself. So in Buddhism, is, in my experiences, I've found the most lucid and clear exposition of the mind, the functioning of the mind, and particularly the functioning of the egoic mind, the ego. It's a very funny word. Psychologically, in Western tradition, ego is important to have, and it means a good thing. And this is just a label, you see. In the Eastern tradition, it's not a thing, it's a process. In fact, in the Western tradition, it also should be understood as a process. It's not a thing, it's a process. It's a way in which the mind functions, and it's a self-defeating way in which the mind functions. It's a limiting way in which the mind functions. It's a contracted way in which the mind functions. And that's at the root of all of our problems. So, in that sense, since this is a course in hypnotherapy, not just simply hypnosis, so there's therapy, which means you're going to work with people to broaden their capacities, you actually are going to be practicing Buddhism, as far as I'm concerned. Okay? In the sense that Buddhism is not a religious, it's not a set of beliefs, it's an actual set of, it's a recognition of process, and it's a recognition of skillful means about how to intervene in that process to help people get better outcomes, or as Faith said, to help people wake up. This course, as you can see, you know, it's a very lots of stuff here, you know. You can be very relaxed about getting lots and lots of techniques, lots and lots of technical information that you can refer to and rely on as you become familiar with it and integrate it into your life. I want you to know right up front, when I took this course, when I finished taking this course, and I had my first clients, and I did many clients for, you know, free, because I was practicing initially. But what I would do is I'd get them to close their eyes. You know, we talk first, you know, find out what we're going to do, and blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm very professional, you know, hypnotic gaze and all. And, but once I had them close their eyes, I very quietly leap to the place. So, if I should, this has happened in the past, that people have, you know, people think that I do this very well, and somewhat get intimidated by it. I just want you to know that you all can do it. You know, it's just a, you know, it's, there's no limits on you, and it's just a matter of what you put into it, where you go with it. And so I want you to know, in the beginning, I literally would do that. And just, you know, read word for word, whatever was the appropriate script. So, since you know it's okay to do that, you can totally relax. You know, you're not going to have to master this stuff during the course of the course. It would be impossible to do that. Okay?
Thank you.
And you won't be and you won't be expected to do that in order to pass the course. The primary thing that gets you through this course is your genuineness. Okay? That's all that matters. In fact, it's been shown, there's been studies, and maybe you studied in the course of your school, but they've studied what kind of therapy techniques work. And the conclusion they found was the same conclusion they found when they studied to find out what a good salesman was that there's no one technique or no one set way that's the right way to do it. It's always the intangible thing, it's always the human connection that makes any, gives life to any technique. So I'm not here to turn you into good mechanics, okay? That can be a tendency in our culture because of the way we've been taught to relate to learning, which is to not learn and to be afraid to learn, to think, you know, that we're sort of putting ourselves in the spotlight if we attempt to learn. So, and what's the really important thing to learn? It's not to think that the techniques is it, and because you can sort of rotely put in a tape and come out with a technique that means you're good. Okay? That's not it. That's not what, I don't care about that. You know, what I care about is connection between here and here. Okay? And I don't judge that, you know, in terms of, well, you've come this far, you're evolved, so you pass. No. As far as I'm concerned, I can tell everyone has passed already. Okay? So there's this one aspect of this course which would be sort of the very traditional technical aspect. You get the fundamental technical understandings and procedures that are sort of very ordinary. But then on the other side, you're going to be constantly exposed to the all-pervasive nature of hypnotic states. We're all in hypnotic states all the time. You don't have to hypnotize people. They're already hypnotized. All of us are already hypnotized. Yeah. We're constantly moving from one altered state to another. And when you can appreciate that, it loosens the whole thing up for you. You see, getting caught in trying to be a good therapist, that's a hypnotic state. It's a very limiting one. I have people come to me all the time, tell me about these people who are these great therapists who, you know, do great work for other people, but they can't do it for themselves. Or they just tell me, why, you know, why can I do this for other people? I can't do it for myself, you know, sitting there chain smoking coffee and isolating themselves from the world. It's because you can learn about therapy and you can learn about psychology and you can learn about diagnostics and not really be exposed to the nature of the mind and to the nature of your own mind in the moment and how it works. So that also, that's very much part of this course, because that to me is the more connection you make with yourself, the more you will enliven these techniques and the more you will evolve the techniques and come up with new techniques. Because all of this stuff just came from people like you. It's all just more or less inspiration in the moment. If you really understand, can have a conviction that, you know, this is not just a tricky thing I'm saying. The people really are, we're always living in our mind. Did you read the little brochure that I sent with the big brochure? You know, that we're living in our mind, not in the world. That's a hypnotic state. That's happening all the time. So if you understand that, then this idea about whether can I hypnotize somebody or not, that goes out the window. This idea about resisting client, that goes out the window. There's no such thing. No, that's the state. That's it. It's not like you have to go somewhere else to get something else. You're being presented with what you need to do to work with. So your clients, you know, therapy, if you understand this, therapy is so simple. Everything is already right there. And you're all, moment by moment, you're being given the instructions what to do next, if you can recognize. Part of recognizing it is developing an awareness that includes your own process at the same time that you're observing your client. And learning to be very generous and kind to yourself. Developing an appreciation that just as your client is not their stuff, you're also not your stuff. That you can allow yourself, you can allow an internal space to open up where whatever you think or feel is entirely workable. For instance, clients will come to you looking for things besides healing. You know, they'll come to you looking for sex, looking for sex, and looking for sex, and other things. And they might not even know it. Or you might be attracted to someone who's coming for therapy. It's okay, in fact, it's imperative to recognize that and give that the space to be there. You see, if you give, and I'm picking sex because it's a very powerful trigger for most of us. It's a very problematic area for most of us. You know, it's generally something that, as a therapist, people will have a taboo about thinking about in relationship to a client, particularly on the spot in a session. So it's a very good example. That's fine. You know, whatever comes up is fine. It's just a thought. It's just a feeling. It's not you. And if you allow it to be, you can appreciate the interplay of energies that's going on in such a way that you can keep things from getting solidified. Solidification, what I mean by that is going into a trance state that will dictate inappropriate behaviors. You know, not necessarily like acting on the desire, but doing all kinds of twisting yourself up inside because you think you're a bad person because you have that feeling. It's all of that kind of stuff is totally wasted energy. And that's a demonstration of what I call the egoic process. Is that it's in a very simple way, it's just fundamentally a contraction. The egoic process goes like this: it contracts and it tries to hold, and there's nothing that can be held onto. It's fine to let any, you know, thoughts and feelings are triggered. You don't own them. You don't have to own them and try to do anything with them. And you'll see that that's the fundamental to what keeps clients stuck as clients, or yourself stuck as yourself, is that you regard something as a problem. We've trained ourselves to think about things in a fixed way. In Buddhism, it's called fixed ideas. That's what the egoic process does, is it creates fixed ideas. Our most profound fixed idea is our idea of who we are. Who we think we are. You know, Jack Elias. For most people, you say their name, you immediately put them into this very profound trance. And you think about it, do you feel like you're separate from your name? Can you be totally dispassionate and objective when you hear your name? It's just two words, you know, for most of us, two words. My Suzuki Roshi was very skillful. I mean, that was his job. He was his Zen master. You know, he could tell what to do for people at just the right moment. And once I went to see him, and I didn't know I was going to get to see him. I went in for meditation. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, come and wait, you know, you're having an audience. And I went, oh, okay, great. So I went and I sat near where he did this and waiting my turn. And something was happening for me. I knew that when I got up in the morning. And so I thought, gee, this is interesting, auspicious coincidence. I'm going to get to see him. And I went in. And I had seen him many times before, and he'd never done this. I went in, and he pushed this pad and pencil over to me. He said, write your name down, please. I'm going, what? He knows who I am. I write my name down, Jack Elias. And I go, you know, it's like, it was just words on a page, and it was like, it was not me. And I just burst into tears. It was very, very profound opening. You know, the difference between me and Jack Lyon. Who we think we are is a very profound hypnotic state.
Why did that happen for you then, when all of the thousands and millions or whatever number of times you've written your name before hadn't happened?
Well, because it happened, I could say it was a, sort of the fruition of my choice of activities, like to be engaged in meditation intensely and to be engaged in it in relationship to a realized being, somebody who's awake, and that it removed the veils. It was like, see, the universe really does support us. Everything is happening in perfect for the highest benefit. And it was an auspicious coincidence, you know, it's called synchronicity, you know? You all know synchronicity, you know, when you're going to go to the grocery store or the movie theater and you just know you're going to get the parking space right in front. You know, it's the busiest time and it happens. It wasn't an accident that I had that opportunity to be with him at that moment. It's when you are ready, you will always get the support you need. I mean, you're always getting the support you need anyway, but in a way that you consciously can recognize and that is significant, sort of like a biggie. It's always there. It's like people worry, you know, most of us have been harmed. I mean, that's the rule, the basic rule of life on Earth, is you come here and you very quickly, usually within the first 6 months, you get shamed. You get split from yourself. You get the strong message, it's not okay to be you. So you go into trance. You go into false self, which is a construct. It's a hypnotic state. It's a trance. It's a way of not being you to protect you. And part of that is organic recognition of abandonment. There's not the clarity of recognition that we've done it to ourselves, but there's the sense of abandonment by the universe, by whatever you want to call it, by this support that for a time we experience organically in the womb. So in a non-conceptual, organic way, there's this sense that God is withholding, if you will. And that is reinforced by the parents. We're already way into the course material. this is how it goes, sort of like this, in circles, I suppose. And it also goes linearly, too. So. But if you think about it, a little child, preconceptual child, you know, preconceptual mentally, has organic, visceral knowledge of their needs, that they know they need to be supported, they know they need to be cared for. And they have a visceral, organic sense, an intuitive sense, an instinctual sense of these people, mother and father, particularly mother, as being the repository of that sustenance in every way, not just food, but love, you know, nurturing. And So there's no way that there can be no conceptual discrimination that this is just a surrogate for the, you know, that the mother is just, you know, should be channeling nurturing energy from the universe, you know, that we're just little bits in the universe. It's like the mother, that's it. The mother is the universe. The mother is God. The father is God. So when shame occurs, when that split occurs and it's preconceptual, then immediately, because we experience withholding parents who teach us very quickly that we have to be a false self in order to get what we need from them, we immediately internalize that as a preconceptual notion of how God is, how the universe is, how we're connected to the ground of being, if you will, or reality in general. And when we grow up, we get in our thinking mind, we go into another trance. We go into the trance of being grown up, you know, and I'm grown up now. Act your age, you're, you know, you don't cry anymore, you're six, you know. So we grow up and we think we leave it behind. But all we do is we displace it, you know. Now instead of being intimidated by our parents and recognizing that they're withholding from us and we have to contort from them, you know, maybe we think, well, we left them behind, you know, we got through that. But then we find that we're relating in that way to whatever you want to call maybe higher power. And we slip into thinking that, you know, we have to grovel to the higher power. Even though if somebody asks us about it conceptually, we say, oh no, it's not, you know, it's blah, blah, blah. But viscerally, that's what we do. That's how we behave. That's how we act. That's how we manipulate our energies. As if we were going to get the same thing from this higher power that we got from our parents.
I'm still back at your, can I describe it as your initiation into higher consciousness?
Sure.
Because that's the way I identify it.
Okay.
With it.
Okay. It was a glimpse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you have a question about it?
Well, I've done some studying. You know, I realize that there's different levels of consciousness, and that only through a living master is the initiation a possibility. And you know, only that through the life process that I've been experiencing. I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm realizing I think completely the blessing of what that is. I guess that's the only way I can describe what that means to me. Why that brings up a lot of feelings for me, I don't know.
It's okay.
Because my feelings just are anymore, I let them happen. I lived my entire life in my brain, and now that I'm living with my feelings, things are so much different. This is all... You know, I realize I've lived 47 years, but it's taken me a long time to get to the point where I can just be me. And the feelings that I have are feelings of joy. They're feelings of going into another unknown, going into... No, it's just, it's only been these last few months that I've been at peace with myself. In fact, I haven't been I've been at peace with myself since I came here. And we had the experience together that we did. And I mean, it's just like revelations, one right after another have been coming and has been clearing out my body and letting go of the pain. And I was one muscle spasm right from one end of my body to the other. And when I come to a new realization or a new thing that I need to let go, my inner child just tells me what that is, and it's been a beautiful experience. I mean, I know now that it took the hell and life's lessons, the hardest ones that I learned the most from, that has happened to me. So I'm thankful for all the lessons. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody, but it makes a lot of sense to me. Thank you for letting me share that. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm
I answer your question? Did you ask me a question? I told that story? Or did you ask Lynn? You asked me the question. Lynn. Why did that happen?
So I went back and that's what happened. You were in the process of going further into the realizing the center of ourselves and how that expands into, is that helping you?
Yeah. I was talking about how we have the genesis of this idea that we're not supported, that things aren't there for us, that somehow we have to compromise ourselves and continue the game of not being ourselves in order to somehow earn.
That's the fifth time now.
Keeping it on its way.
Not the fifth time you've done that either.
I'm sorry. I'm just really giddy tonight here.
It's the same thing I was talking about when I was talking about being a therapist and allowing yourself to experience what you experience, even if it's supposedly a taboo. We have to all move past maintaining a set of standards about who we are. It's too late.
Never too late.
It's too late. It's too late. You're here and you're in motion. Emotion is just in motion. Your energy, you're alive. To be alive is to be in motion. And the simplest thing is the hardest thing for us because of the way we've programmed ourselves, been programmed. You know, we've lost, to a greater or lesser degree, we've lost the ability to simply allow ourselves to be as we are, moment by moment. We're very skillful at having this egoic process take over all the time. Anything has its own territory, such as, oh yeah, I'll just be myself. I'll just be myself. You know, you can't hold on to it. You see, the egoic process is always trying to hold on to what that is. You can't hold on to it. Who you really are is always a state of divine ignorance as opposed to regular ignorance. That's why, if, I don't know if any of you ever read stories about Zen masters, you know, they have all these little stories of, you know, challenging each other, you know, and asking questions and knocking each other with sticks and stuff and doing outrageous things. There's plenty of them that are variations on the theme of where someone will challenge somebody else, you know, who are you? And they'll say, I don't know. They mean it. They're not being cute. But that's an expression of their attainment, of their understanding. That they've come to that place where they've left behind all the trances of who they are. And expressing it, it's like, it's a non, it's the highest form of affirmation. It's total nonverbal affirmation. But it's the highest affirmation of who you are. To just be who you are. Without reservation. Without holding on to anything, without hiding behind anything, without anticipating who you are. I can remember in the first grade, somebody was chasing me around the front of the room, and all of a sudden I yelled, let out this shrill, loud yelp of glee. And everybody stopped in the whole classroom. And I turned around and I said, you did that! You know, it was like, you know, uncontrolled, spontaneous, incredible exuberance. But it put my egoic self on the spot, you know? It's like, whoa, I can't trust this person. You know, and that's because that kind of response came up because of prior shame. You know, we all have learned, we all were always, at some point, always just that ongoing, flowing, unexpected, spontaneous exuberance. And we learned that there were sharp edges that we bump into. And so we learned how to shut it down. That's the egoic process. That's the hypnotic process. That's the real hypnotic process that you need to deal with.
Is there ever a time, in the process, is there ever a time when you move beyond that process?
Yes. Yes.
So that's the natural part of illumination for everyone, is to move past
yes.
that. Okay.
Yes. Okay. And just the same way you'll all pass this course, you'll all get there. Maybe not during the course, but everybody gets there. Sooner or later. If anyone here is sort of wondering how what this has to do with hypnosis, please be patient with me. Because we're talking about hypnosis and hypnotherapy. Doing therapy, you have to learn how to deal with people's models of the world. See, we live in our minds, we live in our models of the world. You all have a model of hypnosis. Even in your ignorance, relative ignorance of what hypnosis is, you all have a model of, of what it is, even if it's just a big question mark. You know, or little bits and fragments of what you've seen or heard, you know, stage hypnotist or whatever. You have an idea of what it is, or you have an idea of what you want to do with it, which is fine. But I want you to recognize that that is just an idea. That's not all that it is. So be patient with me. I'm pretty sure we'll bring everything into it that we need. As far as I'm concerned, what I'm starting off here sort of with the most advanced view, which is to recognize that hypnosis is not something you do to somebody with a certain set of given procedures, although you can do that. But if you think that that's all there is to hypnosis and that that's the only thing that's going on with hypnosis, then you really, as far in my opinion, you're missing the really profound implications that hypnotic research and experience is about. And most people up until now have missed it. It's, you know, everything's changing now very fast. But if you were to You still have time to experience this. It hasn't moved that fast. I mean, once you take this course and if you join hypnotherapy associations, you'll have a chance to go and experience being with a group of hypnotists, and you won't necessarily be particularly impressed with their level of consciousness. You know? And it's because that you can learn about anything and still have it be learning about it in a box, so that you don't apply it in all the appropriate contexts, namely the context of yourself. So that's my emphasis, is to get you to understand the very broad implications, and maybe not understand them all at once, but to learn how to contemplate what the broad implications of something you're learning might be. We're going through the nuts and bolts of sort of basic hypnotic definitions and hypnotic levels and all of that stuff, but I'm going to point out to you that all of those things are characteristic of normal waking consciousness. As an example, to start out with an example of somnambulism. Somnambulism up until recently was considered the deepest state, the deepest hypnotic state. Characteristic of somnambulism would be what we've all experienced, having a vivid dream and then the next second not being able to remember it, spontaneous amnesia. Okay. The ability to have positive or negative hallucinations. A positive hallucination is seeing something that's not there. You see this little poodle right here? And a negative hallucination is not seeing the something that is there. Like, if I were a good stage hypnotist, I could put you into somnambulism and say, now when you wake up, the number 7 will not exist. Okay? And then she wakes up and says, hey, Ben, how are you doing? I said, no. Oh, she's saying, fine. And I said, would you do something really simple for me? Just to humor me? And she'd say, okay, because she's a good sport. And I said, would you count your fingers? She'd say, okay, sure. She'd go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then she would start getting distressed. That's an example of somnambulism, negative hallucination. But if you think about it, we're doing those kinds of things all the time.
It's almost while we're driving.
Isn't that how we navigate in social situations? Not acknowledge rudenesses and insults.
Gee, and they used to send me to behavioral med for that.
Yeah, right.
Ooh.
That's only the fourth state. You say that we all go through all the different states of it consciously. What about catalepsy? Someone's going to dig a hole and put you in it.
Catalepsy?
Yeah. Is that what it was?
Catatonic?
Right.
Catatonic.
Right.
You don't think
no
people
breath,
are catatonic?
No, they're
going to
put you in a
hole. I don't know. Catatonic doesn't just mean like absolute catatonia. How about body armor?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Body armor?
Yeah. Body armor holding emotions?
Yes.
For 20, 30 years at a time?
Yes.
I mean, stage hypnotist gets you to hold your arm out for 5 minutes. Big deal. Nobody can move it. How about 20 years? Yeah? Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
You see how it's now sort of infiltrating regular life now, regular
right.
Ordinary life? Just the example I gave about having something come up that you don't think is a part of you, you know, it doesn't fit your standard of who you are, it's not appropriate for the situation. What do we do with it? We call it denial. What is denial other than negative hallucination? It's not there. It's not death. I'm maintaining my standard, my trance of who I am. They're all the same processes. It's important, in my opinion, it's important to appreciate them. That's why, at this point, I rarely do a lot of the stuff I'm going to teach you in terms of formal trance. And some people here have worked with me, and they'll tell you I rarely say, okay, now we're going to do hypnosis. There's no need to, really.
That's for sure. Boy.
And if anyone here is thinking maybe I wouldn't want to do that, it's too late.
It's already happened.
The view of this kind of therapy, which is not necessarily what you'll meet in any kind of therapeutic, in all kinds of therapeutic modalities, but the view, the very strong conviction of this approach, my approach, is, which is also in line with Buddhist philosophy, is that we're inherently pure, that we're inherently perfect, that we're inherently indestructible, that there's nothing wrong with us, that we don't have to create sanity, we don't have to create goodness, we don't have to create health. Buddhist imagery would be, in terms of what I'm talking about now, would be enlightenment, the enlightened state, like liberated state, aware state, whatever. That's not something you have to create. It's already, you already have it. And the, one of the images trying to describe that would be that it's like this, like Seattle weather, you know, overcast. When it's overcast, there's nobody here that starts biting their fingernails and wondering if a giant dragon ate the sun, which is what they used to think. You know the sun is there behind the clouds. You know you're not going to have to do anything to create the sun. You just have to wait for the clouds to move. It's the same with neurosis, psychosis, whatever, is that what you're shooting for is not to create some kind of purity in a person. You're just trying to get the clouds out of the way so that it can shine. This is very significant implications in terms of the power of this kind of work, the rapidity with which you get change in this kind of work, and the simplicity and the ease with which you get change rapidly in this kind of work. I have people coming to me all the time who go to psychiatrists, psychologists, all kinds of people, and come away with an affirmation of their brokenness, with an affirmation that they're afflicted, with an affirmation that there's something wrong with them they need to be ashamed about. In other words, they've been, they went in with this trance, and whoever they talked to had the same similar kind of trance, and it just reinforced it. Diagnostics might have its place, but I don't think, it hardly ever has its place, in my opinion, and being communicated to the client, because it's just a label, it's just a fixed idea, it's a limiting idea. And it just affirms, it affirms to them in a very, with a lot of implications, unconscious implications, that there's something wrong with them, and that the resources aren't there, and that they'll probably never find them. This is entirely the opposite approach. This view is that because the inherent purity is indestructible and self-existent within each of us, therefore all the resourcefulness we need is within each of us. In fact, all the resources we need to overcome our problems are within our problems.
Why
Why is this feeling like an inner child workshop?
Well, I don't know. Same ideas.
Yeah.
Same insights.
Yeah.
Fixed ideas, problems which are just fixed ideas, okay? Problems are fixed ideas and habitual patterns of behavior based on those fixed ideas, which are the instructions. That's just a patterning, temporary patterning of energy, of the fundamental energy, which is inherently pure. You see, it's all just dressed up. It's fundamentally pure, it's fundamentally free. In fact, it's so free, it's free to indulge in taking all these contorted, painful forms on a temporary basis. But it's just temporary. And all the power that goes into creating a temporary manifestation of patterning is the same power that will dissolve it. So you don't have to go anywhere else to solve a problem, to find the resources to solve a problem. Someone came to me once, had been to seen a psychologist. First session, talked to him for a while. Psychologist said he was obviously had chronic depressive syndrome and he should be on drugs. Told him to immediately make an appointment with a psychiatrist to get the drugs he needed. Well, he came to see me instead, and he never went to get the drugs, and he stopped being depressed because instead of treating it as an affliction, I asked him, I was very curious about how he did it. And he, what are you talking about? How do I do what? How do you do depression? How do you do, you see, depression, this is NLP. You know, depression is a noun, right? Depression is a noun. Everybody knows what a noun is, a person, place, or thing, teacher, okay? Chronic depressive syndrome. He has chronic depression. Everything is process. Okay? Nouns are hypnotic trances. You see, this is in NLP, this would be called a nominalization. Nominalization. Okay? Nominalization, that means you're changing a process into a thing. You see? You're changing a process into a thing.
Giving it a name which makes it a problem.
Right. And makes it something outside of yourself. It's like you can be afflicted by a thing. You know, a thing can come along and attach itself to you. Which is a somnambulistic trance, negative hallucination and positive hallucination and amnesia. You're amnesic to the fact that you're depressing yourself. It's a verb, it's a process, it's an activity. Activity, something you do. It's a behavior, something you do. You create it in an ongoing way. It's a choice. It has a strategy, you know. Every action is a strategy.
What about chemical depression?
Hold on, okay?
Oh.
So, when you're depressing yourself, one of the things you have to do to keep this up is to hand it over to your so-called unconscious mind. You can't do it consciously. It takes too much energy. Just like you couldn't, there's no way. Anybody here think they could consciously ride a bike? You know? Mm-hmm. Just sort of rattle off to all those 700-800 muscles, just exactly everything they got to do, you know, every second to keep, you know, balancing. You know? Anybody think I could consciously ride a bike? No way. Well, same thing. This is a complex process. In order for it to operate smoothly with precision and elegance, it's a very elegant process, being chronically depressed. Elegance in its form, not its nature. Okay? In its precision, in its impeccable, ongoing precision. It's a process. But in order for it to maintain itself, which means in order to have it have to go amnesiac about it, to have your so you don't see it, so it's not there. So that all you get are the byproducts of it, the results of it, then the explanation is that there's this thing that's doing it to you. Well, this thing is a trance, it's a fiction. It's a total fiction. So of course it takes a long time to fix it. People who get fixed in a modality that tries to fix the thing, and they actually get fixed, it was an auspicious coincidence. Somewhere along the line, they did something about the process, and they probably didn't notice it. Because they're still consciously, so-called conscious mind, is still focusing on that this is what we were doing. And they say, oh, wonderful cure! But then it doesn't work for very many people. Well, why doesn't it work for everybody? Because what they're saying it was is not what it was at all. And they totally, unless they had the awareness to be looking in this direction, they missed what they did right. Like the Nobel Prize winners the other day, did you read about them? They got the Nobel Prize for making the discovery of this enzyme. It wasn't at all what they were trying to do. It was a total accident that they discovered this thing, that they get the Nobel Prize for. This, incredible, it's going to allow us to unravel the genetic code completely. They had no idea, that wasn't what they were doing at all. Something went wrong with their experiment. That's the way most incredible things happen. It's just like this fortuitous mistake. We weren't going for it at all. It just sort of, reality surprised us, gave us this gift. So, certainly if somebody has been labeled as having chronic depressive syndrome, which is a bigger name than just depression, and thinks it's an affliction, and it's afflicting them, and they have no responsibility in it, and the power that it's not being supported from within their own being, that it's not a patterning of their own energy, which they ultimately have control of course it's going to be a terrible long haul. But if you focus their awareness to the source of it, which is within them, which is that it's a behavior, it's something they're doing, and that they have the power to do it, right away you give people a sense of empowerment without even changing anything. What incredible power you must have to be able to maintain this incredible state. Think about all the skill and intelligence and all the mechanisms you've mastered to create this incredible, magnificent thing. It's over here, it's in this big black space. But the blackness of it and the power of the blackness of it is just an indication of the power of your own being. The power of your capacity to focus and persevere and et cetera, et cetera. Now all we need to do, now that you recognize that, is move out of that darkness, move it over here into the light, into doing things that you like. And that's it in a nutshell. That's not just it about depression, that's it about anything. This is the, what would the word be? Etiology or epistemology or ideology? This is the fundamental name of the game here.
It's accountability a lot, it seems to me, that you have to take account, be accountable for a lot of your conditions.
All of them.
Yeah.
We're from a Buddhist point of view, in my opinion, and you don't even have to believe this, you see. Because this course is not, please don't think that if I spout so-called spiritual truths, you don't have to accept them as truths. I want you to test them as procedures. So you don't have to believe that we're at cause. I don't want to have a metaphysical argument about whether or not we're at cause. What I want you to do is to find out how powerful it is as a treatment modality to get people to take the orientation of being at cause. it works. I don't care if it's true. It empowers people. It moves, it gets them moving out of their limitations, which would imply that it's true.
Does it engender guilt if they can't move out?
There's no way they can't move out. There's no way, because can't move out is just an indication of the power to move out.
Do you believe that there might be a karmic reason why someone is leaving this plane in this body early?
Mm-hmm.
So are you saying that's in control of the person too?
Mm-hmm. And you don't know. There's no statement you can make about which way it's going to go. Like, some people are going to leave because whatever the karmic composition of that situation is, they're not going to change it.
Even though there's a power. You just said they could change it.
Yeah, they can, but they're not going to. They're going to choose not to.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't mean they couldn't have. You know, I believe that, you know, there is no defining rule. We define it the way we want it, and we choose it. And it's a matter of focus and diligence and focus. How we focus, how we create it, is how we create it. There's no rules that says you have, you know, there's no rules that say you have to die of AIDS. No, even if you're on your deathbed, you could come back from it. But all the ingredients have to be there. You know, there's no rules as can or can't, but there are rules of procedure. There are universal laws about how things do change. And unless you get into that stream, it won't change. But that's not a matter of an absolute can or can't. That's a matter of do you do it or don't you do it. And sometimes you don't get all the ingredients in order to override what might look like a predestined karma. Although anything can, as far as I'm concerned, anything could theoretically be overridden. It's just whether it is or it isn't, it's only a matter of description. It's not a matter of setting up a law. It's just, well, it didn't happen here, and maybe we could see what, you know, what the reason why was, or maybe we won't know, but it's just that it did happen or it didn't. It's not...